All right, so we'll get started. Perfect. It's a bright and early Saturday morning here in Tokyo. Welcome back to one more episode of Sake on Air, the world's one and only podcast dedicated to the adventures of sake and shochu. We're based here in Japan at the... We're recording every other week here in Japan. What are we doing? We're recording stuff. It's early. Woo!
The people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first, it was kind of soy sauce. It was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day, 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history.
Welcome. You are listening to one more episode of Sake on Air, the world's number one podcast for anything and everything sake and shochu, recording here at the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center here in Tokyo. I am one of your regular co-hosts here on the show. My name is Justin Potts, and I have a couple of partners in crime with me here today. One would be our regular man behind the mic, Mr. Chris Hughes.
Hello.
Good morning. And just for our listeners, just so you know, so they decided to start constructing a skyscraper.
is that what they're doing?
I'm based on the nature of the sound that's coming... Yeah. From right over yonder.
They are pile driving.
Something's going on there. So for our listeners, if there's a little something shifty going on in the background there, that is...
It could be.
That is, there could be a little bit of sound going on there. So apologies this week. They didn't warn us that they were about to reconstruct a small corner of Tokyo on the morning we're planning to record. So we're just going to have to roll with it. We have... a lot to dig into today because we have a very special guest, Mr. Cody Brailsford. Brailsford.
Good morning.
Good morning. Morning, Cody.
And good morning. Chris. Morning, Cody.
Cody is joining us all the way out from Gifu. You are a sake brewer, a kurabito at Watanabe Shuzo, makers of Hodai, correct?
Yes, that is true. I've been brewing for Watanabe Sake Brewery for, since 2006. So this will be my 14th, so starting in next month, I guess, will be the 14th season in the brewery as a kurabito. Yeah.
Excellent. And so you're still a kurabito for the time being, but you had some news apparently.
Yeah, I came in to work a few days ago, and the president of Watanabe, Hikma, asked me to come into the office and asked if I wanted to, what my thoughts were becoming the assistant head, so the fukutoji over this next season. And so I was kindly very shocking at the same time. It was not good news, I guess.
You'll find out this season.
Yeah, congratulations.
Well, thank you so much.
I feel it's been a long time coming. You've been there a long time and very much deserved.
Yeah, it's definitely a journey, to say the least. Definitely ups and downs with pretty much anything. But I'm excited about it, but quite nervous at the same time. You know, I talked to my colleague Philip Harper about it over the phone, and he's all, "Yeah, everybody's kind of nervous when you get to that point." And so I think it should be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have faith in you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, we've had a couple of people here who have been brewing, or non-Japanese individuals who have been brewing in some capacity for some stint, or, you know, in a number of different areas, both here and overseas. And the number of non-Japanese people brewing here in Japan is increasing. You're starting to see more people kind of pop up. But Mr. Philip Harper aside, as from what I know, you're the only individual who's really been in it for the long game, for a really extended period of time. I mean, there's a handful of people who have been on, you know, stints for say 3 or 4 years or so. You see a lot of people come in for training, or they're doing sales overseas, or they're doing, you know, for one reason or another, they're in there for a month, 1 year, or they come for a season or something. But you have been in it to a degree that, honestly, I don't know anybody else who hasn't. So I'm really, you were talking about those sort of ups and downs along the way. I'm really curious to sort of hear about those today.
Well, it's besides Philip Harper, I guess I've been in the industry 50 plus years now, but definitely it's been a lot of curves and hills to kind of go over. Because, you know, when I started the brewery, you know, one of the members on the brewing staff was, you know, you'll be here a week. And so I'm the type of individual where, you know, if I kind of see a challenge ahead of me, you know, I'm not going to give up anytime soon. And so knowing nothing, you know, because I was a huge fan of Japanese sake, but, you know, I didn't know, again, anything about it. And so, and then in regards to brewing itself, you know, that was a totally different obstacle. They were willing to, you know, try it out for a year. And then after the first year, you know, they asked me to take 3 months off. And then they asked me to come back. And so I was just kind of surprised, you know, that happened in the first place anyways. But in regards to, you know, the terminology, you know, the tools, you know, the techniques, the communication with your colleagues, these all play huge factors in, you know, how the sake is produced as well, besides just the techniques in general. But, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to take a step back for just a minute, and I'm curious how you ended up there in the first place. Of all the sake breweries scattered about Japan, what sent you out to Watanabe
and sake breweries? How did you discover sake in the first place? You said, so you've been in the industry like close to 50, did you say?
Yeah, I've been in the industry about 15 years now.
15 years, okay.
I first discovered sake, or my first experience with sake, was in Washington, D.C., actually, and it was hot sake, and I didn't know what it was, but all my colleagues, we went to a Japanese restaurant, and they were drinking this, and at first, I couldn't swallow it, you know, it just didn't work, you know, and then my second glass, I was like, oh, maybe it was because I was drunk or not, I don't know, but tastes good, and then my wife's Japanese, and okay. So it was kind of how it all kind of collaborated with the sake. But and then we chose to come back to Japan to live and during shogats, more or less. I was drinking with my father-in-law, and it just so happened that the sake was Horai's, the brewery that I work for now. But it was a more mellow, more sweeter type, crisp, you know, type of sake thing. It was kind of exact opposite to what I originally discovered back in D.C. And so, and at the time, you know, through the development, we eventually came back to live in Japan. And as my wife was looking for something for me to do work-wise, you know, the brewery at Watanabe was actually hiring. And so she asked if I was interested in actually working just kind of developed after that.
So you met your wife overseas in the U.S. then? And so your connection to Japan or with her was entirely in the U.S. until you decided to make the move back? Or how did that sort of come about? Did you have time in Japan prior to making the big move?
No, I met her in college through a friend. And so my interaction with Japan or the Japanese culture all started then, more or less. Prior to that, I had no exposure or anything to the Japanese culture or sake in general. And so that's kind of how it really developed after that. So,
and then is she from Hida and that area there?
Yeah, she's from Hida, Takayama. So she was born and raised in Hida, Takayama. And and that's main reason, again, we had more or less headed back to that area as well. So
that's a big move to make. Right, to have your entire experience together be in the U.S. And it's one thing to pick up and say, oh, maybe we'll go back to Japan, but to pick up and go back to the countryside where you guys are at, that's a big move.
Yeah, it was definitely because back in the States, I was in the medical profession, and to pick up actually what I was doing back then and actually resigning all of a sudden within a year's period of time and then moving back to Japan without having a job at all, and then being asked to actually work for a sake brewery, you know, with a rich history, was, you know, almost a nightmare to anybody else. I was open for the challenge, I guess.
Yeah. Well, what sort of instigated your move back to Japan? What was sort of facilitating that?
More or less, to raise our children, and so it really wasn't anything. In general, you know, eventually when we got married, we chose, if the opportunity arose, you know, we would move back to Japan to raise our children. But, you know, I didn't ever assume that it would happen that soon, you know. But at the time, you know, it really just was the situation back in the States. And after graduating in DC, and we actually, I landed my first job in Texas, and so and it was all, of all places, it was in East Texas, and so more or less the segregation was huge, very still present, and my wife was having difficulty with that. Being Japanese, and definitely there were several occasions that arose that, you know, definitely she was being segregated against, and she just called it quits, you know, and she's all, you know, I don't want to move back to another state, I just gonna go back to my own country, you know. That's kind of how it all kind of arose in regards to that soon of a period of time. So
well, where you're at now really is, I've been lucky enough, I've had the opportunity to go out and visit not just your brewery but the area a few times, and you guys are really in a truly beautiful, beautiful place out there. So when it comes to a place to raise children, arguably I can't think of a better place, really. You did well, sir.
yeah it's definitely beautiful, very green, very cold in the winter though, snows quite a bit, and so, but it doesn't changed much from the area that I grew up in, Utah, and so it's in regards to that, it seems very homely to me, and I think that's the main reason why it's so easy for me to live there, is because it's so similar to, you know, the area that I grew up in back in Utah.
So you said that you got long winters. Does that mean you have a long brewing season then as well?
Yeah, definitely. The brewing season is very long. We roughly start in September and finish the following June. And so so it's definitely a long winter in general. Not much exposure to the outside world, I guess.
So just to give kind of everybody, our listeners, sort of an idea about Watanabe Sake Brewery and Hodai, you want to tell us just a little bit about the brewery? What sort of... How large are you guys in the grand scheme of things in your area, in the sort of with regards to the larger industry? What sort of product do you make? Okay.
Watanabe Sake Brewery is roughly celebrating their 150th year this year, and so roughly the company started in 1870. Prior to that, the company was actually in the business of creating raw silk, and so really the family business started in 1732, and then when the fourth generation president more or less was selling his product in Kyoto, I guess the silk sales were, you know, I don't quite know exactly how it all turned out, but he celebrated that evening drinking Japanese sake and referred to it as a golden drops, and actually wanted to come back and produce his own brewery. And so really that's how it all began at Watanabe Sake Brewery. But in regards to the grand scheme of how much we produce and the areas that we focus on, we're roughly at this particular point. I think I saw a scale, let's see, last year, I think we were ranked 47th in production size. So we're roughly making about 6,200 koku a year. And that's actually increasing on a yearly basis as well. So we're definitely growing as a brewery. We're getting also to a point where we'll start producing sake from year-round, starting probably next year. And so that will, again, bring a totally different scheme to the whole production in general.
You've had a lot of success recently in the various competitions, not just at home but overseas as well. And has that success kind of changed the way that you brew, or the flavor profiles that you're producing? I suppose you will have expanded your range, product range, because of that.
Yeah, definitely. We've had a lot of success, not only domestically but internationally, in regards to the competitions. And definitely it has changed the more or less flavor profile in regards to our products as well. But I think good and bad, I think that Watanabe Sake Brewery's president is more or less gearing towards the competitions versus actually the other areas. So I guess it's a teeter-totter in regards to how well we balance the competitions versus, you know, more or less gearing the sake towards the customers. And so
How like, what percentage of your customer base is local, would you say? It's quite a small brewery, and it's in like a quite a, you know, it's like quite a rural part of Japan, I think. So Yeah, how much compared to?
Roughly about 80% of our production is sold locally. And so there hasn't been really a lot of emphasis until recently to actually sell it outside the Hida region or Gifu in general. And so that's the main reason why we're slowly but surely having our sake kind of exposed to bigger cities like Tokyo and Osaka and such areas.
And you have your own sake, right? Not many, you know, people brewing in Japan or anyone really, you know, it's not Japanese, can kind of attest to having their own sake. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I started, that started roughly quite a while ago, roughly about my sixth or seventh year. I wanted to actually design or start promoting our sake to America or other outside foreign countries. And so at that particular time, the president says, you know, we're not ready. You know, he didn't kind of want to, step on in that area quite yet. And so starting my 10th season, actually, Semu, more or less, Watanabe's general manager, I was talking to John Gottner and up at the Sake Fair in July, actually. And we actually hired him to come in and actually consult for us to kind of create a product for the U.S. market. Anyways, that's really how it all started. The president more or less mentioned that if, you know, we're going to actually introduce our sake to the American market, we're asking you to pretty much do everything, produce the sake, produce the design, the colors, you know, everything in regards to the labels. And so it's definitely an oddball out of most traditional Japanese sake bottles and designs, but yeah. It does expose my
name. You have one called Ninja, right? Or I saw it on a YouTube video. Some YouTubers went to Gifu Prefecture, and I think they got it on a vending machine or something.
They was actually doing a pachinko.
With the
Horai Sake Ninja.
It's great. You know, non-Japanese people, I mean, if they know Japan, Ninja is going to be a pretty, you know, dead cert, isn't it?
I know. But that was actually my initial idea, was to actually do the Ninja. But I know the president was doing the chomage, you know, he wanted to do a chomage style or something like that. And I didn't think the chomage was going to work out anytime soon. And then, you know, we were talking about doing some oddball stuff, creating a sake that was exclusively served on Air Force One, you know. And so, you know, doing these oddball things, you know, produced a label for that as well. And then, you know, as soon as we talked to, you know, our U.S. importer, he's all, "You're nuts, you know, this would never work. This would never work at first, you know." And so, yeah, he kind of shut us down.
You have a dream, don't you? Like, you always, I've seen on, you can confirm this, but on the programs that I've seen you appear in Japan, sometimes you're on TV, I think, you know, and you say that your kind of dream is one day, you tell us what your dream is. It's quite cool.
Yeah, I'm kind of an oddball out of in the industry, I guess. I actually wrote a letter to the Prime Minister of Japan and actually used the local delegate to actually push my letter and sake all the way to the top. But it was my dream to actually serve the President of the United States, the sake that I produced at Watanabe Sake Brewery. So I wanted more or less Cody's sake to be served at or G7 or, you know. And I'm still looking, you know, I'm still working on it. You know, I haven't given up quite yet. But it really went through, actually. The Prime Minister Abe tasted it. Unfortunately, President Trump doesn't drink sake at all. But no. Supposedly it was given as a present to the President of the United States. But I have not yet confirmed that yet.
That's so cool. So cool.
Very cool. So there's... Well, kind of, I'm going to step back just kind of a little bit. So you go into the brewery, you said it's changed quite a bit, your, you know, position with regards to the international market. From when you first entered the brewery to where you are now, when you first got in, so you weren't exporting at all, that wasn't something that was in the sights of the brewery in any way, shape, or form. You guys were entirely focused domestically at that time.
Yeah, that's correct. Most of the focus, the president thought that initially, if we can't sell it locally, there's no way in hell that we can sell it internationally. And so most of his focus was to sell it on a local spectrum. And so,
what was it? What was sort of the turning point, do you think, that got them to start thinking, gosh, maybe we have this amazing resource here working with us every day. Maybe we should start thinking about where we can take this.
I think it was exactly that, actually. I think it was just how they more or less directed my upbringing in the sake industry, you know, to the point where they felt comfortable enough to actually use me as a resource to more or less expose Horai sake to the international market. And so I think it was just a timing more than anything. Very hesitant, of course, yeah. I think it's just about time. So,
brewing sake and selling sake are two very different worlds, and you guys have a pretty long season, and you guys are pretty hunkered down there doing your thing, I have a feeling. Was sort of making that transition to international communication and sales and things like that, was that challenging for you? Was that exciting for you? What was, when you first started doing that, what was sort of in your mind? And
yeah, I actually still have difficulty actually all the time. My main focus has been on brewing sake and to actually talk about it, not only in my native tongue, that because all the terminology, you know, everything that I've done up to this point in regards to sake production, is everything's been done in Japanese, and so I only know one way to actually talk about it. And so to actually transfer that into an English conversation, you know, I almost kind of start sweating every time, you know. But over the years, it's slowly but surely become more comfortable. Some things I've noticed, you know, you really have to keep it simple, except for those people that really know what they're talking about, you know, the geeks, you know, and the other people. And then you're able to kind of go into the more in-depth discussions. But it's definitely still very challenging on those aspects.
Do you feel like your presence within the brewery over the years, do you feel like that has changed or influenced the culture of the brewery in any way, shape or form?
I hope so. You know, I hope that it, you know, it's kind of opened or broadened their perspective on how more or less sake is more or less perceived on an international spectrum. And then domestically as well, because, you know, Takayama, the next adjacent town from Hida Furukawa, is a huge tourist trap. And then recently, you know, they've been heading over to Furukawa, and so definitely we're having that exposure now, you know. And so it's getting to a point where, you know, we're doing English conversations, lessons at the brewery, and so it's nice to kind of see how that's kind of evolved over time.
How many other breweries are there in the area? Because I know Hida Takayama has a whole stretch, like a whole kind of road with like maybe 9 breweries in there, and that might be an overestimate, but how many? I know you, there's, because when I visited you, I went to that other one down the
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic, a little old.
Yeah, there's actually 12 breweries in that region, actually. What I didn't know, though, was roughly in the 17th century, there was actually over 60 breweries in the Hida region.
That's the case in a lot of different places.
And you know, I never knew that until recently. There's roughly 12 breweries, and roughly 7 are located in Takayama. There's 2 in Hida Furukawa. And then 1 in Kamioka. And then as you go towards Gedo, there's 2 in that area as well.
Mm-hmm. So have you been opening up the brewery more in different ways? Not just to international visitors, but to domestic visitors as well. How do you guys, like I said, where you guys are at, it's beautiful out there. Mm-hmm. And it's the type of place, whether you're from Japan or whether you're visiting from afar, it's a lovely place to go and spend a day or two. And you guys are right smack in the heart of all of that. Have you been sort of looking at ways of opening the brewery up to people at all?
Yeah, we actually have started doing brewery tours for the last 2+ years now. we've slowly done it over time. At first, where it started with free tours, where we kind of briefly brought them in, and then took them out. But recently, we've been doing how would you say it? Paid tours. Paid tours. And so we actually have them actually go in and see the Kamaya, you know, and actually see how deep it is, you know, and then actually we take them up to the Kojimuro, and you know, and if we're actually doing work in there, we'll actually ask them to assist with the process, and so they can actually get hands-on experience. And then we take them over to the Moromi. And actually, if we're doing, you know, kaide or any other work, we ask them, you know, if of course they want to assist, and then, you know, so it's more or less, we've gotten to the point where, you know, we've created a program where customers can actually come in and instead of actually hearing and listening to somebody talk, actually experience, you know, themselves some of the processes.
You have a lovely shop as well. It's a very nice little shop as well. You can...
Yeah, it's definitely gotten bigger. Actually, it's funny that you say, because we're actually doing a lot of construction in the brewery right now, and so we're actually talking about creating a restaurant store adjacent to the brewery now. And so there's a lot of open conversation in regards to how to kind of push the envelope in regards to those areas.
You guys, so scale-wise, you guys are in kind of an interesting position with the amount that you produce. There's a lot of really small places, but you guys are still a far leap from the big places, for sure. So you guys are, you'd be kind of in the middle to high end of the mid range, I guess, in the kind of the grand scheme of things. And then when you said 80% of your product is still consumed locally, locally, isn't that big.
I was impressed by that personally.
Just the number of people and just the relative price point for probably what people are willing or able to pay within that that area. You guys are in kind of a very unique position. I imagine it's very challenging as you're looking. You said you're sort of scaling. I'm sort of interested in what that scaling process has looked like over the last few years. Sort of where are you looking at for markets and sort of what you see changing and sort of the challenges there.
Well, definitely the Hita region, they drink sake like water, right? And so, you know, and they believe that the next adjacent town, Hita Takayama, so they believe that Hita Furukawa drinks more sake than Hita Takayama. And so I don't know how it all works, but in regards to the skills, how we kind of push the envelope to the other areas and how we expose to the other different markets, not outside the local Gifu area, is definitely changed over time. I found that even though our production is slowly increasing, I believe the sales are slowly decreasing. And so I think not only has the president and the general manager kind of realized finally that those areas are declining, and so I think that's the main reason why we're kind of pushing into the bigger cities. But with that being said, I think personally, I think we're so far behind in regards to the other breweries that are really established here already. And so, and this, especially with the international market as well, it's the same. I think we've almost taken too much time. We've been almost too scared to actually kind of attack those areas, and so I think it's a plus and negative in both areas. But I think it's just going to take time more than anything. And then how we actually do it, definitely the company is very hesitant to actually doing promotional events, and so that's some of the areas that I've kind of really been talking to the president about, is actually exposing, doing different events. Like last month, we did an event at Hotel Chinsanso, but it was very small. Again, there was only 12 plus customers that came, but I think those small events will eventually lead up to bigger events that, you know, will kind of expose the product in general.
So when you're scanning, we were talking, so we're, for those who can't see us, we're sitting under a what would be the base of a kioke or a wooden barrel that is, or a wooden cask. I guess you could say that it would be used for brewing for that fermentation mash here. And you were just saying when you came in, you looked up at that and said, oh, we just got ours back. We're going to start using that this year. You're adding one to the mix this year.
Yeah, so we're actually doing a lot of construction in the brewery right now, but we actually are celebrating our 150th year this year in with Watanabe. And I was, me and the Toji-san were actually sitting down in the office, and we thought, you know, what would be something different to kind of celebrate the 150th year? And we had a big, well, we still have a big warehouse that, and we just stick stuff in, you know, kind of, and forget about it. But I was actually in there, actually placing some wood. And I noticed there was two kioke, you know, in there, and I was all, well, you know, why don't we take this and refurbish it and then actually use it for 150th year. And so it took a year or so. We got the president's approval on that, and we transferred the kioke down to a place in Sakai City.
In Osaka.
Yeah, in Osaka. And we just got it back a few days ago, and so, yeah, it's beautiful. They took a slice. I guess it was an open slice when they actually refurbished it. And it was roughly, the kioke was roughly produced roughly 170 years ago. And so it was a lot of fun to kind of see those areas.
Just to elaborate just very quickly for our listeners, it's not normal to actually use wooden, tanks to brew sake. It's done in, you know, stainless steel or aluminium tanks, isn't it? So to actually bring these like out, you know, of the dust and use them is quite special, isn't it? And we, in previous podcasts, we've touched upon it, but kioke are very special because there aren't that many people around that make them anymore. And it's generally used for they're used for soy sauce and other things as well, aren't they? But for sake, it's kind of, it's quite rare and special.
Yeah, it's really a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to it. And we're actually talking about all sorts of different things. Actually, prior to coming into Tokyo this trip, we're talking about creating a kijoshu, and then we're talking about in regards to kijoshu, the licenses associated with it, you know.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Because technically you have to be part of this association, right? And
exactly.
It's all kind of managed from down in Hiroshima, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very briefly, did we explain what a kijoshu is in any previous podcast? I'm just racking my brains thinking perhaps we might have done.
The name has probably popped up, but I don't think we've talked about it in any sort in any sort of detail at
You want
all.
To do the honors,
well,
Cody?
I'm still actually learning about it myself, and so I think I'd probably feel more comfortable with Chris going over the information.
Well, I mean, probably the simplest way to explain kijoshu, I mean, normally when you brew sake, you use water. Okay, so you have, if I was to explain the kind of the recipe for brewing sake, it would be 80% white rice. Okay, this is just the standard recipe, and 20% which is actually turned into koji. And then you add 130 parts water. Okay, so what happens when you make a kijoshu is basically they replace some of the parts of water with sake. Yeah. Normally it's sake from the previous year or from another year or something, and what happens is what makes kijoshu quite special, it's quite luxurious because, you know, adding sake to sake is, you know, there's an expense involved with that. Kijoshu itself goes back a long, long way. Like they found scrolls with evidence of kijoshu in it. But thing is, the kijoshu being mentioned in the scrolls is not the kijoshu that they make today. It's a little bit different. But the kijoshu that they make today was revived by a brewery in Hiroshima Prefecture, Inoki Shuzo. And they made a little association, and you have to be part of this association to make kijoshu. But what makes kijoshu quite special is that what happens is, because you're adding alcohol to the fermentation very early on, the thing about yeast is it actually has quite a low tolerance to alcohol. It might surprise you. But it's a poison. The yeast. So by increasing the alcohol, what happens, you actually weaken the yeast, so it stops a lot earlier, and you end up with a lot of sugar left over. So kijoshu tends to be quite sweet, quite acidic, but very, very nice, very, you know, and it's great for aging. You're going to age your Kijoshu?
Yeah, they were actually talking about aging it, you know, and taking a small portion and then adding it to the next year's batch, you know, and going on, you know, more or less creating a legacy. So what we, what the discussion was is for 150th year, when we turn 160 and 170, have a more or less a history back to the 150th year. Mm-hmm. And so they want to continue to make the Kijoshu, you know, from this point on.
And then have
it actually come back and be referred to as the 150th year production.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, we'll have to do an episode on that one day, because it is starting to pop up a lot more. You're starting to see more places try and tackle that and different interpretations of that. I have some interesting stories about Kijoshu. Actually, we'll save those for another day.
Well, yeah, because you work quite close to a kind of a.
We'll get into it. There's some interesting challenges involved in making that happen sometimes. Yeah. But so kind of stepping back to your sort of experience within the brewery as well too. A lot of times when you, and irrespective of being Japanese or not Japanese, getting into sake brewing, a lot of people associate the lifestyle with a lot of physical demand. I imagine. But you're in good shape. You say you used to play college sports and stuff, right? I doubt that that's something you can probably adapt to a degree, the physical learns. But I think there's probably a lot of other things that were, I imagine, challenging at first, aside from just, you know, language and physical, you know, the physical demands on that. I'm sort of curious, what were the things that initially that were maybe exciting as well as challenging to you at first, and sort of how those things have sort of changed. Now you're taking over as Fukutoji, so I imagine there's a whole plethora of challenging things that are that might await you. But and sort of how your experience has sort of changed over time, and sort of the challenges and things that you've seen.
Yeah, when I started the brewery, I was quite big, actually bigger than I am now. Right now I'm roughly about 94, so I'm still big. But when I started the brewery, I was actually roughly over 130 kilos.
You know? Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so I was actually a big boy.
If you didn't get into sake, you probably might have been sumo wrestling or something.
And so they called me Mike Bernardo, the wrestler. They call me all sorts of things like the heat of Bruce Willis. I still never understand. I think it's just because of my bald head. Yeah. But coming back to this the question. But there was definitely a lot of challenges physically wise. They were definitely that was an area that they thought that wouldn't be a problem, because I was bigger, but I didn't assume that there would be so much physical activity, and so that's the first, during my first year, I went from all the way from 130 down to roughly about 82, and so I lost a lot of weight within my first
year. In one year.
Wow.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
And so, I always refer to it as the Watanabe diet, Yeah. Back to the question again, some of the biggest challenges I had at first was, again, communication, because most of my coworkers were from Iwate Prefecture, so definitely the dialect was a huge factor at first, and it just didn't make sense, mochoi, and I thought, and so these small words. But at that particular time, again, my Japanese was very little, but besides the language factors, the food, was a huge factor. So every morning, again, we eat, more or less sleep at the brewery. And every morning we have miso soup, egg, nori, so seaweed, and rice. And I've never had a raw egg before, prior to coming to Japan, actually. And so my first day in the brewery, I was sitting there and I had a bowl of miso soup, and I thought, you gotta be kidding, this is a raw egg, I feel like I'm Rocky or something, stick it in a cup and chug it down. But I didn't know how to eat it, and so there was those small challenges such as food issues, and and eating rice on a daily basis, you know, some of those basic challenges.
So you say they're small challenges, but those are really, really big challenges when you have, when your entire being has been cultivated by a completely different diet for 20 years, 30 years, and then all of a sudden it changes. I mean, a lot of people who, you know, listen now, like, gosh, it'd be so nice to be able to have great Japanese food every day. But when you're, when that's not what you signed up for necessarily, and all of a sudden that's, you know, that's on you every day. That's really demanding.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely it was, yeah. Initially when I also started, you know, the toji would sit down, and before you would actually pick up your chopsticks, the toji would first have to eat. And so that tradition, you know, says, and so those little miniature challenges, but, yeah. But, back to the second part of the question.
Yeah, no, that's okay. So then when you first got, there was obviously a lot of challenges at first and things you had to get used to. What was it that it was exciting for you at first? I imagine the whole experience was just very intense. I imagine when you first got started, you probably could, maybe it's kind of a blur, kind of a dream at this point now. But what was when you said, okay, I'm going to get into sake. What was the spark for you? What?
I think, it comes back that, when I first started the brewery, within the first month or so, after producing, our first batch, there was, a newspaper company had come in for article, and actually the Toji-san took out actually a batch of the press sake from the tank and actually served it. And I think that was my first huge impression. You know, I saw this is really, you know, what it's all about. You know, and I was so fascinated. You know, the taste, the complexities. You know, and I think that's really what kind of pushed me over the edge. You know, like, oh, this is really cool. You know. This is something definitely I can kind of really get hooked on to, you know, more than anything. And so I think it was just those really small things that kind of really build up to a bigger idea or image than anything. Because at first, really, it was just about work. You know, I was looking to find a job that I really enjoyed, and then it kind of developed into something I really had have a lot of passion for, you know. And so, because more than anything, you know, I wanted to go from what I was doing before to a job that I really felt passionate about, you know, wanting to go to work on it. Because I felt like if you don't have passion, especially in the sake production, then, you know, you can't continue this work, you know, because it's so strenuous. And so not only physically, but mentally as well. And so, I think that's really pushes me on a daily basis is, next year sake, you know, definitely challenges will arise, but it's those things that I want to make the sake better and better and better over time.
Yeah. You said it is challenging over time. It is when you're in there doing it every day, you can kind of lose sight of a lot of other things that are going on, I think, because you're so, it takes over. Kind of, I think, everything. Yeah. You know, were there any times along the way when you thought, you know, maybe I've had enough of this? Were there any really challenging times or anything where you thought, you know, this has been fun, but.
You know, to be honest, no.
Yeah.
I found that what I've kind of discovered or, I don't know, evolved, or I don't know how you would put it, but I've always just really enjoyed it, you know. I really enjoy getting my hands dirty. I really enjoy, you know, the really weird things about the production, the hot steam, you know, the smell of the moromi, you know, the stinky socks, you know, in refers to the koji, you know, in regards to, it's the small things that kind of push me.
You were just going to say, you play kabuki to your moromi, don't you? I went there and you were playing kabuki. Is that your idea or no?
No, that was actually the president, you know, Watanabe's.
Oh, okay.
You know, president, but Yeah, it's quite annoying, actually.
Oh, right, you don't like it. Kabuki is a little bit jarring, isn't it? Yeah, it's nice to watch, but to work with in the background.
Well, and so you play Kabuki. Kabuki is visual.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm having trouble picturing what's.
Yeah, I have the same problem on a daily basis because I have to listen on it on a daily basis. But they believe that actually if the sake is laughing when it ferments, that it'll actually have the same effect on the customers when they drink it, so it'll make the customers laugh. Mm-hmm. But
kind of to replace the shikomi uta, isn't it? The song that they used to sing when they were fermenting, and now there's all this kind of. These ideas around, might have to do a podcast about, you know, kind of music and sake, but just kind of an idea.
Round up a list of all the different breweries that are playing or showing.
Jazz or Mozart or whatever. Mozart's a popular one. Jazz and rock are popular as well, but I'd never come across Kabuki before. You know, and it was good. There it was going in the background. Ooh, then all that stuff, you know, and it was like, yeah, wow.
Yeah, it's, we actually do sing all the time though. Prior Toji Sora, the Daitoji, it's funny, we'd always sing, and so he more or less implemented a program where we're all singing during the production.
Are they Japanese songs?
Yeah, Japanese songs.
You have to learn them? Are they famous Japanese songs? Or are they just kind
of like, they're all from the more or less Nambu Guild, you know, and so he's more or less printed all that information and then kind of broken it down so that, and then every day after work, we'll take roughly about 15 minutes and then we'll go over the songs. So more or less everybody has a time that they actually learn the songs in general. So.
Very nice. Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. You give us a rendition?
I'll pass today.
We'll have to open one or two of those bottles behind us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You have to have sake in your system before you sing.
I was actually just going to touch on that. You mentioned Iwate came up a couple times in the conversation. You just mentioned the Nambu Toji. So you have somebody, do you have somebody traveling every year to come operate as your toji, or sort of how, what sort of system do you have in place there, and how has that changed?
That's actually changed quite a bit. It's nice that you bring that up, because the president actually, Watanabe, is chosen over the next year. Up until this point, we've had more or less
contracted employees.
But from now on, it's more or less, we're trying to implement a seishin or a full-time employee system.
Yeah.
And so starting this next year, so starting next month, we'll have two people come in from Iwate, but the rest of the members are actually full-time employees. And then the people from Iwate will be here for one more year, and then next year we'll be entirely full-time employees in general. So it's solely changed.
So you'll be taking over for those that have been traveling from Iwate then. So they're going for one more year, they're going to come, and then after that, see you later. We're going to take it from here. Is that kind of the...
Yeah, that's more or less the plan in general. He wanted to more or less implement a full-time employee system during the... it's what been 5+ years now since we more or less designed that, or, you know, it was slowly decreasing on a yearly basis. And this will be our last year in regards to that.
So slowly decreasing the number of part-time employees, switching them over to. Yeah. So have you found, does that change people's employees or brewers' relationship or sort of disposition with regards to the relationship with the product and their work? Have you found that to influence that at all?
Well, it brings a lot of extra work, because you have to do the training. And then, especially with the part-time employees, you know, they've been doing it for years and years and years. And then they're going to more or less the study sessions to more or less increase their knowledge on a yearly basis. And so we've kind of had to implement that with our full-time employees, where they're actually going to the different guilds now and actually studying about sake. But again, if it all comes back to whether or not if you have the passion to actually do the work, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's also been a big turn in regards to when you talked about the product, how it's changed. It definitely has changed, you know, I feel, in regards, but I think that's all associated with the system in general. So
right, I find that really interesting. So just other places I've visited or places that I've talked to, I mean, people, if they're hired to come in for 4 months to work for, you know, $8 an hour or whatever to do a specific task versus having a commitment to the product for, you know, 365 days a year and all of the peripheral things that come along with that, it creates a very different relationship. And sometimes it's maybe not necessarily a matter of better or worse, but some people like their seasonal relationship, you know, so asking somebody to make that change is sometimes a welcome change for some people. And sometimes it's really challenging. And sometimes a lot of places I found when they decide to shift over to that sort of full-time system, as much as they'd like to keep their previous staff, that's not necessarily what they were looking for. So they end up having to go out and find new people who are into that. So it's a very complicated, I imagine it's true in any industry as well, but given sort of the peculiar nature of the sake business and sort of all that entails, I imagine it's a very challenging shift that it,
It definitely has been a challenge. Back to that note, number guilds normally, when I first started the brewery, they were very hesitant to actually teach you about anything because they're afraid that you're going to take their job. Mm-hmm. Well, it just really comes back to that. You know, we're getting to a point where we're implementing a full time and generating the part time, and I've also seen that, you know that they feel like they don't want to teach because next year, you know, they're not going to be there. And mm-hmm. so even though they accept the invitation to actually come in and help with the production, they're still very hesitant to actually mm-hmm. teach you know, more or less their skills. And so, you know, that's very controversial in regards mm-hmm. to those issues.
And I suppose that's especially sensitive right now where we are, because of where we are with the Toji system, more and more breweries disbanding it, and generally just a lot of very old Toji who, you know, won't be with us forever, and not enough young people to kind of take over the reins. And a lot of Toji guilds are really suffering with their numbers and stuff. So I think it's kind of a bit of self-preservation there, isn't it?
Yeah, that is definitely true. I've been associated with the Nambu guild for a good 10 plus years now. And recently, I've made the change and transfer over to Noto. So I'm actually in the Noto guild now. And one thing I've noticed with the Noto guild is there's a lot of young Toji-san,
right?
Which is really nice, you know.
Yeah.
It's easy to conversate with them. They're very open-minded. And so it's really quite interesting, very educational.
Have you met the master?
Yes, I have. I've met him several times. And he's a wonderful gentleman, but very hard to understand. And so, yeah, I kind of nod my head.
Yeah, we're referring to Mr. Noguchi, who recently came out of retirement.
This
80-year-old chap who came out of retirement to kind of train young people. Mm-hmm. And I haven't met him yet. Have you met him, Justin?
I haven't yet, no.
No.
I'm curious spurred your, why did you make the switch? Why go from Nambu to Noto? Was there something, if you can talk about that, or to what degree you can, if there was you hear, you know, about a lot of people saying, you know, we're not going to worry about the guild thing. We'll just take it, we'll do it ourselves. But to actually make a conscious decision to switch, was that?
Well, I can't say too much about it.
Yeah.
It was actually a really controversial issue, because up until this point, we've actually had two Toji-san that were actually employed at Watanabe, and they are both being Nambu guild Toji-sans, and one wanted me to actually continue with Nambu, but the other wanted me to go towards Noto because of the younger generation. And then, you know, we're also taking a shift, shifting from Sokujo into Kimoto and Yamahai as well. And so I think that's also another reason why he's kind of pushed me towards the Noto area. It was just more or less, I felt that Noto was also younger, easier to understand, easier to kind of integrate into their system. Because Nambu tends to be a little bit Well, they have a wide range of, you know, and diversity in regards to the age. But yeah, it was mostly because of the age.
No, and it's big. I mean, numbers. It's
huge,
right?
And well, so it's the biggest, isn't it? It's the one in charge, basically. Yeah.
So I don't want to cut my bridges.
Yeah, not at all. So I'm just curious. I mean, they're
very different.
They're in different places.
Yeah.
You know, and they both have an incredible amount of skill and resources to offer. So it's how do you, right? I think probably all of the breweries are thinking about this is every one of these places has something really, really important, special to offer.
Yeah.
And how do you utilize that in a way that's going to
benefit,
you know, benefit the industry as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has.
And it's worth mentioning that it's not uncommon for breweries to change their guild. No. It's actually very common. My breweries I've been to said, well, last year we were this guild, but, you know, especially now, with the nature of, you know, with the fact that so many guilds now are losing their members, or, you know, they don't have enough members to kind of...
Well, you can actually be associated with two guilds.
At the same time, right?
At
yeah.
the same time.
You are allowed to, aren't you?
Yeah, and so, and we were actually talking about that as well. Be a Nambu and a Noto, but that didn't work out.
I couldn't do a 50-50. couldn't share it.
And so, yeah.
Well, I could see, you can see a lot of, like, you know, arguments happening within the brewery. No, this is not the way we do it. And you know, Noto, by the way, because I don't think we said yet, is Ishikawa Prefecture's guild, or that area. Like, it's a bit bigger than Ishikawa Prefecture, but yeah, the Noto Peninsula.
Noto's another beautiful place.
It's
a spectacular place as well.
You've been. They've invited you down to like these kind of like seminars or things.
Yeah, actually, next Tuesday I'm going up to the summer Bank Yokai or
So jealous.
Can I get an invitation?
Yeah.
I would be curious.
Can I?
Be
very, oh, okay.
Yeah, but it's beautiful up there.
Yeah, it's really lovely. Real quick, just because we're kind of, you know, running out of time here, just kind of wind things down a little bit. You're talking about, you just mentioned, you know, you're shifted to new guild, new styles, looking at the younger generation. You said you're going to start shifting over to Yamaha, to Kimoto and these things. Looking ahead, what's sort of inspiring what's motivating the changes and what kind of has you excited kind of going forward with you personally as well, of course, Fukutoji now as well, but just, you know, looking forward, what are the things you kind of have on your radar and what are you excited about right now?
I'm excited about a lot of different things. Definitely, last year was our first year of creating Kimoto. It's always been my dream. You know, up until this point of my career in the sake production, I've never done Kimoto. And we're talking about Yamaha within the near future. And so really that area, you know, up until this point, the Watanabe's president's been very hesitant about going into the area. And so it's been kind of difficult. But I think with our new Toji, is putting a lot of different insight into what it actually can become turn into in regards to the cells and, you know, the traditional side of things. And I think the president's very, very open-minded, become very open-minded compared to before. And so what I'm really looking forward to is just really going into that really realm, more areas that I really don't feel that comfortable with, and something that, you know, I can really learn and kind of develop, and so, you know, that's really what I'm looking forward to more than anything.
What's next? Is there anything you want to share for anybody who's interested in Horai Sake, where they should go, or is there anything special words or messages you want to share to our listeners?
Well, if you ever have a chance, Horai, again, is a smaller brewery, but definitely we create a sake that has a huge impact. And who knows, you know, even after, with a laughing fermentation, maybe it'll make you even laugh after you drink it. But it's a growing brewery. But if you have a chance, please. Yeah. Without hesitation.
And you're available in what different countries now? What's your availability like?
Right now we're in Europe, well, in the UK, we started implementing in Germany a little bit, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, the United States, and so a little bit into Canada. Nice.
So if you Google Hourai, Hourai, and Cody together, you can probably track it down.
Actually, if you look up HTTP dot hyphen hyphen sakehourai dot com, it'll bring up the English webpage. So
perfect. Cody, thank you so much for making time this morning on bright and early on a Saturday.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks. We'll have to come back when I'm curious to. We'll have to have you back after your first year of Fukutoji experience,
and Kimoto.
You'll have
to give us Kimoto as well. Tell us how the Kimoto,
the Kyoke, and all that. Yeah. We'll have to do. We'll have to do a catch up round.
I'd love that. You know, and again, I'd love you guys to come to the brewery as well if you're in the region. You know,
absolutely. Absolutely, Dennis. I'm actually going to be out that way in November, so I'll give you a holler.
I look forward to it.
Excellent. Thanks again so much, Cody. And Chris.
Thank you.
What's about it? That was another episode of Sake On Air. Thank you so much to our listeners. You can follow us at Sake On Air on all of your favorite social media channels. If you have any questions for us, you can get in touch. We would love to hear your feedback, your ideas, your thoughts. You can message us at questions@sakeonair.com. For those of you who have messaged but maybe haven't heard back, we just discovered a little bit of a bug in our mail server, but I have found it, and we will be getting back to you shortly. So apologize if you have sent a message over the last month or so and you didn't get a prompt response. So just a heads up there, but we will be following up shortly. And this has been another episode broadcast from the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center in Tokyo. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, cheers. We'll be back in another couple of weeks.